Hello and welcome to episode 17 of Women's Soccer Zone. Lovely to have you back with us as always, and making his return after his absence in the last episode, my good friend from Our Game magazine, JJ Duke. JJ, how you doing, mate?
Yeah, Kieran, good to be back.
Tell you what, mate, you were very close to being replaced because Jen from Equalizer Soccer did do a very good job in your absence. So you must consider yourself lucky, my friend, because you were very close to being binned.
Well, hey, you know, I guess squad rotation at the end of the day only it helps and enhances competition. So that means I've got to bring my A game today.
Absolutely, absolutely. I could never bin you, mate, but squad rotation is the exact way that we need to look at it. Now, we're doing things a bit differently this week. There's been a lot going on in the world of women's football, and due to the fact that we have two quite high profile and quite long interviews, we're going to be splitting the shows into two parts. So this is episode 17 part 1. Episode 17 part 2 will be out later in the week, and in this part we're going to focus on the FAWSL. So we're going to have a quick look at some of the fixtures that have taken place. The UEFA Women's Champions League draw last 32 is due to take place on Thursday, so we're going to have a quick look at some of the teams that will be competing, and there's an unseeded side in there that teams in the seeded pot will definitely want to avoid. We're going to have a quick look at the Valley Cup, which was of course won by Bayern Munich out in Switzerland, and we will also have a quick look at the FIFA Women's World Cup All-Star squad that was announced this week. Some notable omissions in there, and we have finally an interview with the US Women's National Team's Becky Sauerbrunn, someone I've wanted to get on for a little while. So let's get cracking without further ado.
Women's Soccer Zone. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSOZone.
So welcome back. We will start this show with a very brief look at the FAWSL. Just the one set of fixtures since we last spoke, JJ. There's been a lot of Continental Cup fixtures since you and I were speaking on the last episode. And to be honest, the Continental Cup is pretty much going as planned. It's FAWSL 1 clubs giving FAWSL 2 clubs, in some cases, a bit of a hiding. So no real surprises there. But the main game that's taken place since we last spoke was at Arsenal Ladies, who were overcome by the very in-form Manchester City women in a 3-2 victory for the girls in blue. Now, I don't know how much of the WSL you've seen, mate, but it is getting very tight up there at the moment.
Yeah, it is. No, I did have a chance to take a look at the highlights of this one. You know, full credit to Manchester City for, you know, taking care of business. And you guys, and I always appreciate that you call it the business end of the season. This is where teams have to start making their mark. And now Manchester City has put themselves in a brilliant position. 3 points back of Chelsea, match in hand. You know, they're scoring, goals for fun, they're not conceding a whole lot either. So the goal difference is going to help them. And, you know, you continue to win matches like this, grind out results against top opponents, you may find yourself in a good position to see yourself at the end of the top of the table. And, you know, Manchester City women, they've been, as you've said in prior occasions, the one of the few teams in Europe right now that are truly opening up the bank to bring in some good talent, and they want Champions League football.
Yeah, and looking at the way that they played, I was actually at that game, very solid in defence in the first half especially. They really did stifle Arsenal's width, because that is a strength of Arsenal's. They've really been using Marta Corredera, who's their new Spanish acquisition since the World Cup, and Kioma Ubagagu, who we've spoken about on previous shows as having been really impressive for Arsenal. And a player that's really stood out since the World Cup is Lucy Bronze, and she goes from strength to strength.
No, that she does. I mean, you know, pace on the flanks, can, you know, come up and attack when you need to, but, and then at the same time, and we were treated to this when she played her season with the University of North Carolina's, she can be a real strong point in back. And you look at that back four right now from Manchester City, you have four internationals that are starting. That you'll take that any day of the week.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a blow for Arsenal, because another home defeat, obviously, was at the game that they lost to Liverpool Ladies at home a few weeks ago. And it's difficult for them because they are missing a number of players. Vicky Lasada was missing from the Manchester City defeat. Jordan Nobbs was missing. Leah Williamson was missing. Essentially, their starting midfield three, if they continue to play 4-3-3, were all out. So you can understand that maybe Pedro Losa is going to be concerned by that and is going to feel that his team is slightly weakened. But take nothing away from Man City. And I have to say, mate, I've spoken about it before, Daphne Corbo is doing a very good job for the club.
Oh, absolutely. We knew this was going to happen. Even Jim Gabara admitted to it during the NWSL draft that he didn't have much of a chance to sign her, knowing that Daphne was going to go overseas. And you could see it. She uses that combination of her technical ability and the pace and strength that she picked up while playing the American game. And that fits. You know, European teams, we're going to see this when, you know, kind of maybe transitioning a little bit into the Champions League, that you have those all lone players going over to play Champions League matches because of the pace and because that American players can bring that little extra physicality and strength and also know how to play in high priority matches to get the job done. You can see that Corbos is transitioning beautifully. So is Ubagago as well for Arsenal.
Yeah, absolutely. Good to have those American players over here playing in our league. Well, just going away from the WSL very quickly, mate, but also related. Steph Houghton, the Manchester City women's captain, was recently named in the top 50 most influential women in sport in the UK. She was actually named number 4. Obviously, not only is she the Manchester City captain, she's the England captain as well. And being that I managed to grab a few interviews after the game, I did manage to pull Steph aside and ask her how it felt to be named amongst some very, very influential women who have a big, big impact on sport in this country. And here's what she had to say.
I've got to ask about a list that was released today by The Independent, which had you fourth as one of the 50 most influential women in sport. Did you have a little smirk when you saw that?
You know what? I didn't even realise it was on until I got tweeted it this morning. So, obviously delighted, but at the same time shocked, so... But I think it's great for women's football that they've got the likes of me, Casey and Eleola Luco in that influential women in sport. And I think it just shows how much women's football's came along and it improved over this year. And the fact that the World Cup's been a massive part of English football this year and this season, it's great for us. And to be in with some great names like Claire Bolden and Jessica Ennis, it's great to be up there.
And it's a sign of women's sport getting a recognition as well, the fact that lists like this are being put together, because maybe a few years ago we wouldn't have seen anything like that.
Yeah, I think so. I think the amount of tweets and messages and phone calls I've had to say congratulations just shows how far women's sport and how much people are taking notice of it and respecting us as athletes and people involved. So overall, very delighted that the list come out, yeah.
When you see yourself sort of play so highly, does it feel a bit of added pressure and a little bit of a burden that you're having to kind of carry that torch a little bit?
No, I don't think I look at it like that. I think of myself as a footballer that's ambitious and wants to play for Manchester City in England and play as well as I can every single week. And I take my job as a captain of both England and City very seriously and a role model for young girls. And I feel as though for myself personally, just to keep going the way that I'm going, keep enjoying my football and all that stuff that comes away from football, I take it in my stride and make sure that I try and encourage young girls to start playing.
2016 list, Stephanie Houghton at number one.
Let's hope so.
Thanks, Steph.
Thank you.
So that was Steph Houghton. Going back to the WSL, JJ, I am interested, or I would like to point out, that Bristol Academy did finally get their first win of the season, and it came courtesy of a goal from their Equatorial Guinea player, Jade Bohosayo. Now, it's an interesting story with her because she was playing for Equatorial Guinea in an Olympic qualifying game and she had to fly back 4,000 miles. But she had a long journey, didn't arrive until the Tuesday, then had to play for her club at Notts County and got the only goal of the game to give Bristol Academy their win. I mean, an incredible story when you think about the mileage that she's had to clock up.
Yeah, they always talk about these days about how you can recover from taking long trips, obviously here in the U.S. with the NWSL games, when you fly, say, from New Jersey to Seattle, that's not an easy flight to make. But sometimes maybe it might be one of those things that you have such little turnaround that you don't think about it and you just go out there with what you have. And yeah, no, that's incredible.
Yeah, and incredible for Bristol Academy as well. You know, this was a few days after Notts County had taken part in an FA Cup final at Wembley. You know, they, despite the fact that the result didn't go their way, we know that they lost 1-0 to Chelsea Ladies. They they will have been on a high after that game, and they would have, well, they won't be on a high from the result, but on a high from playing at Wembley Stadium, and you would have thought that they would have been looking to take that into their first league game. And unfortunately for them, you know, it didn't go their way. So a really good result for Bristol Academy, and great for new manager Willie Kirk, who of course took over from Dave Edmondson, who resigned earlier in the season. But moving on, and there was a convincing win for Chelsea ladies, who have now reclaimed top spot. And Frank Kirby was on the score sheet in a 4-0 win over Birmingham ladies. Good start for her.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have Annie Aluko also getting on the board twice. And, you know, she's one of the players we were almost reintroduced here during the World Cup a bit. Her pace, you know, how deadly that can be. And we saw it also in that FA Cup final, where all she would do is just sprint down the left side of the field. Chelsea, not saying launching balls over the top, but play it into space and let Aluko run onto it. And, you know, when she's in form and Fran Kirby is scoring goals now, yeah, that's a very tough team to beat.
Yeah, absolutely. Chelsea overtaking Sunderland ladies, who were held by champions Liverpool. But Sunderland continuing to impress, and Beth Mead on the score sheet again against the champions. Euro 2017 qualifiers start in the autumn. JJ, is it pretty much nailed on in your view that Beth Mead is going to be in that, in Mark Sampson's squad? Because for me, she has to be.
Agreed. Has to be. If a player is scoring, you want a goal scorer. That, you know, if you're a forward and you're putting the ball in the back of the net, a manager has to take someone that's on form. And we've seen it, you know, leading up to the World Cup, especially one Fran Kirby, who did nothing but score goals for Reading. So it doesn't matter where you're playing. If you're scoring, you have a chance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, as mentioned, there haven't been a huge number of games in the FAWSL League campaign, because as I mentioned, there's been a lot of Continental Cup football, which we'll go into when the later rounds come in. But as I said, there's been some quite heavy scores involving WSL 1 and WSL 2 sides, so we will talk about it when it gets into the later rounds. But that will conclude our chat on the FAWSL, and when we come back, JJ and I are going to have a very quick look at the upcoming UEFA Women's Champions League draw, which takes place this Thursday.
Women's Soccer Zone would like to thank our partners, She Kicks Magazine. Subscribe at shekicks.net for even more women's football.
So, welcome back. As already discussed, we've gone through what's been happening in the FAWSL. Now time to move on to the UEFA Women's Champions League. Last couple of weeks, the UEFA Women's Champions League qualifying has been taking place for those teams that fall out of the major nations. And we now have our final 32. Notable names in there are ones that people will recognise, the likes of FFC Frankfurt, Wolfsburg, Olympique Lyonnais, Paris Saint-Germain, Liverpool Ladies. Those are the seeded teams, JJ, but in the unseeded pot, we find English runners-up and newly crowned FA Cup champions at Chelsea Ladies. That is a team that people will want to avoid.
Oh, there's always that one match. You know, we could think a couple of years ago, it was PSG, and well, now names changed about a few times, but PSG in there.
Oh, Tirso.
Yeah, PSG and Tirso going in the round of 32 with, not last year, but the year before. That was, you know, the high climax match that everyone was looking forward to, littered with international stars. And, you know, Chelsea may not have that big of a ring to it, but still, obviously, first the pedigree of the name, Chelsea Football Club. You know, we know what they're all about on the men's side. The women's side now, you know, being that team that, you know, has a lot of different styles of attack they can go at you, and it is a team that could be an issue for the likes of a Rosengard or a Brondby, who, you know, made that amazing run in last year's tournament. Teams are not going to want to play Chelsea, and Chelsea should be enjoying that kind of almost threat that they impose.
And it's an argument that I've had on this show previously. We've been doing it for 2.5 years, and it's an argument that I've put forward the last 2 years that the Champions League has come up. I understand that Chelsea Ladies have no previous record in this competition, and for that reason they are unseeded. However, Chelsea Ladies play in arguably one of the stronger competitions in Europe, in the FAWSL. Now, for that reason alone, for me, they should be a seeded team, because we are going to get another situation where a big team is going out early and we end up with, and with the greatest respect, we end up with a Bromby in the semi-final who got absolutely annihilated by FFC Frankfurt. And to tell the truth, I don't want to see that again, because I'm almost on a constant basis when these big scorelines are happening in later rounds, I'm having to defend the competition to friends and people who don't necessarily follow the game. And I'm telling them how great women's football is. And they're saying, well, hold on a minute. We saw the Women's Champions League semi-final scorelines the other day, and Bromby were absolutely annihilated by Frankfurt. And it's not the first time it's happened. I think Tirso gave Neulenbach of Austria a bit of a hiding 2 years ago. And I don't want to see that in the later rounds. And I want to see the better teams seeded so that they avoid each other in the early rounds. And when the business end of the competition gets to that point, we've got the best teams playing against the best teams.
And I agree with that. And I think it even flaws further back the fact that we're having knockout rounds being played right from the get-go. And we don't have the group stage where we may be able to, not to say eliminate the minnows of the competition, but to show who's the strongest out of each group. I mean, if a team, hey, you know, say if we had that 8 groups of 4 teams, and we have like an FC Twente who's, you know, they're always a dominant team in the, well, the BNE League, and now eventually what will be the Netherlands First Division. Say if they upset a team, good for them. Then they deserve to be there in the sense of they got through the group stage. But, you know, we're going to have at least always, and it's going to be every year, there's going to be one team that should be in the last 8. That gets eliminated in the round of 32, and now they have to basically wait for another year before they have to hope that they're not being in that unseeded pot, as opposed to, you know, what it is. And I'm still a believer that they should find a way to have some sort of a group stage. I don't know how it's going to happen. I know they have it in the qualifying stage to get to this point, and teams will have to, or leagues will have to stop or have breaks for the teams that are in it. If they have to centralize each location over a 2-week period, so be it. But there's a lot of things that we hoped could have had change by now, and we haven't, and we're still going to have the same issues come up year after year.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I look at FC Zurich being a seeded side, for example, absolutely battered in the Valais Cup by Lyon 9-3. And, you know, I just genuinely can't see Chelsea Ladies being beaten by that scoreline by Lyon. Granted, it's a friendly tournament, and I don't want it to come across as disrespectful. That's the last thing I want. You know, these clubs are here on merit. I don't deny that for a second. I agree with you as well. It's called the UEFA Women's Champions League. Many of the big clubs never enter a league stage because all of the league element of the competition is played in the earlier rounds, and it's the smaller clubs that are playing in that part of the competition. The likes of Lyon and Paris Saint-Germain and even Glasgow City this year, they haven't played in a league. There has been no league element of the competition. It's only these teams enter at the round of 32. It's a knockout competition. So either make it a knockout competition all the way through, or make it a league like the competition in the men's game. And then I don't know if that's going to make any difference, but I just don't want to see big scorelines in later rounds. I think it devalues the competition, and I've been on my high horse about this a number of times, so I'm going to leave it there. But I mentioned FC Zurich, and I've mentioned Lyon, and I've mentioned the Valais Cup, and it's a friendly tournament that takes place in Switzerland. It involved FC Zurich, Lyon, Paris Saint-Germain, and German champions Bayern Munich. And it was Munich who came out on top after a final 3-1 victory over Lyon. Bit of a surprise, that one, mate.
Yes and no. I think this is something that Munich has been building for a few years now. Obviously, you know, the result, they beat such a high quality team in, you know, a championship match. Yeah, 3-1 scoreline, maybe a little more shocking, but Munich has been a team on the rise. They're building a squad. They've been doing it for some time now. Now with, you know, folks know, even at stateside, when Munich came over for a couple of friendly matches when the German league was in its off season, we know who's on that team. That's a very good team, and, you know, they should be now in their year in the Champions League. Might not necessarily be a preview, but with Germany now with three teams in the competition due to Frankfurt as the holders, and also we have Munich as well as Wolfsburg. There is a possibility that we're going to have at least one, maybe two, who knows, could be three German teams in that semifinal.
Yeah, and one of those German teams has just signed Yuki Egimi as well, one German team to another, left Wolfsburg and joined FFC Frankfurt. But I digress. I think I saw that final between Lyon and Bayern Munich, and you can tell that the French national team is made up largely of Lyon players, because Lyon play almost an identical style of football. Very possession-based, very dominant, create an awful lot of chances. But the reality is that despite that dominance and despite having the large run of the play, they couldn't finish their chances, and Bayern Munich punished them. You know, it was granted it was an own goal that got them the lead by Aurélie Kärcsi, who obviously has joined Lyon from PSG. And then Louisa Nassib scored straight after half-time from a free kick. But then Bayern, they did what they do best. They caught them on the counter-attack with two goals, and it was Vivian Miedema and Nicole Rolser, who's recently joined the club from Liverpool Ladies, who scored the second and third. And, you know, I think you're right. I think what we saw was a very strong Bayern team who will impress, I think, a few people when they play in the Champions League, as long as they can avoid Chelsea and don't get knocked out at the 32 stage. But I think what we saw was a team that will continue to get stronger. Vera Boquet didn't even play in that final. So she's due to come back into the team, and they will be strong. They will be strong, no doubt about that, and I'm interested to see how they get on. And as for Lyon, we know that they are a strong team. They've added players such as Claire Lavalger. We know they've lost players like Lara Dickenman, but the large majority of that squad that played over the last few years is still together. And looking at the two other teams, Zurich and PSG especially, Anja Mittag has come in, so she will add a lot of quality to that team, and we know the strengths that they've got in reaching the UEFA Women's Champions League final. So it was an interesting tournament. I'm not sure we learn a lot from it in terms of what it will mean for the club's domestic and European competitions moving forward, but an interesting insight into how those teams might line up. But yeah, interesting one for me. Congratulations to Bayern Munich on winning that competition. And I think we'll wrap the Valet Cup up there, mate. And when we come back, we've got a couple of awards that we need to discuss. So when we come back after this break, we shall do that. So we'll be back just after this.
Women's Soccer Zone. It's all about the players.
So welcome back. JJ, I mentioned before the break, we've got a couple of awards to discuss. The first one is the Best Player in Europe award. We know that it was narrowed down to a list of 10, I think it was, a few weeks ago. That list last week was narrowed down to a final three, and it was Celia Sasic, Jennifer Marajan, who both represented FFC Frankfurt last season, and Lyon's Amandine Henry, with the winner announced on the 27th of August in Monaco. So number one, what do you make of that list of three? And number two, who in your head is going to win it?
Fair. I think, you know, a lot of people, at least stateside, are really starting to appreciate the work rate that Amandine Henry brings to the women's game. Can play that holding midfield, but then at the same time can push up forward. Celia Sasic, we know what she can bring to the table there. We can just kind of leave it at that. And, you know, Jennifer Marajan, still a young player, still growing, may have not had the World Cup she was hoping for, but so obviously the German team reaching the semifinal round, you know, no disrespect there. So the solid team, in my opinion. I think it is almost kind of bookends that Sasic would be taking the award home.
I think for me, despite the fact that she's been playing at a high level, and despite the fact that she has been playing for one of the best clubs in Europe over the last 5 or 6 years, the World Cup was the stage that Amandine Henry was able to show the world what she was able to do and what she was capable of, because we know in the past that she's not been named in France squads because of relationships with previous managers. And this was a real opportunity for her to almost come out of the shadows of Louisa Nassib and Camille Abeli. Those two in particular in that French midfield get a lot of attention and a lot of plaudits. And Amandine Henry has kind of gone about her business for Lyon, and she hasn't been getting into that France team. But in the last year, 18 months, since the change of coach, she has been in that team. She has been able to show what she's capable of. And for me, that's why I think she should win it. I think she's the best in the world in that position. I don't think that there are many players like her. She's as comfortable on the ball as any attacking player, but she protects that back four for France and for Lyon very well. And we saw from the World Cup, from the goal that she scored against Mexico, she can strike a ball as well.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. You know, any of those three are definitely deserving, and you know, fair points on all that. You know, for me, again, as I said, Celia Sosic, outside of Germany just falling short of winning the World Cup, she did about everything that a footballer could have wanted in, you know, the past calendar year, 12 months or so. So that's where I am, you know, sitting. Goal scorer, you know, can set the tempo of a game, speed it up, slow it down. Dangerous, still dangerous. And yeah, that's where I'm standing.
Yeah, fair point. And it would be almost ironic if Celia Sasic won it, because she's obviously retired. So this would be going to a player who is now no longer involved in the game. And of course, can't forget about Jennifer Marijan. Wonderful, wonderful player. Incredibly gifted. Don't think she got the opportunities at the World Cup that maybe she would have liked. Started a lot of games on the bench and was almost used as an impact sub. But there is a lot more to come from Jennifer Marijan, and we saw what she is capable of in helping FFC Frankfurt win the UEFA Women's Champions League. So as mentioned, that award will be announced, the winner will be announced on the 27th of August, and we will no doubt discuss that on this show when it is done so. Now, last thing before we go into our interview with Becky Sauerbrunn, I said there was a couple of awards. The other one that I wanted to discuss was the FIFA Women's World Cup All-Star Squad, which was named by the technical team at FIFA after the tournament. So essentially, it announces the best players in each position. Essentially, it names a squad of players that they felt were the best players over the course of the tournament. So when it was announced on the day of recording, it would be fair to say that US fans, and quite a few people to be fair, blew up because Becky Sauerbrunn was omitted. That was the most notable, wasn't it?
No, it was. I mean, you know, you look at the list. Goalkeepers, fine with Unger, Bardsley, and Solo. They all had impacts. Midfielders and forwards. You know, again, there's always going to be a talking point. You and I both know this. Working sports, whether if it's football or anything else, that there's always going to be some sort of controversy. I think the midfielders and forwards group is pretty fair. But yeah, I don't know. Becky Sauerbrunn had an amazing tournament, partnering with Julie Johnson at center back. Not going to take anything away from any of the players that were named in the defenders group, but yeah, that's one that was omitted and should have not been.
Yeah, and that's the argument, isn't it? I think people will always say, why isn't that player in? But then you look at the defense: Sayori Ariyoshi, Lucy Bronze, Khadisha Buchanan, Steph Horton, Julie Johnston, Megan Klingenberg, Wendy Renard. All those players had a great tournament, and the question is, who do you take out to put Becky Sauerbrunn in there? I think Becky Sauerbrunn should be in there. She was in my team of the tournament alongside Julie Johnston. I thought those two were superb during the World Cup. There will be arguments for Ali Krieger to be in there. I thought she was the second best right back behind Lucy Bronze. I think Lucy Bronze was the best right back in the tournament. I think it's great that Karen Bardsley is in there, but for me, Lydia Williams had a very good tournament for Australia. Granted, they didn't go beyond the quarterfinals, but I thought she had a very good tournament as well. I look at the midfield. Ramona Backerman, Lisa Devanna, Amandine Henry, Elise Kellen-Knight, Eugenia Le Sommer, Carly Lloyd, and Anya Mittag. I'm not really sure why Anya Mittag is classed as a midfielder, because
they put midfielders and forwards together.
Oh, they have put midfielders and forwards, but well done for correcting me, mate. So Anya Mittag, Aimee Yama, Megan Rapinoe, Mizuno Sakaguchi, Celia Sasic, Elodie Tamise, and Rumi Utsugi. I mean, Elodie Tamise for me, mate, there was arguments. I was watching the Valet Cup final, and Elodie Tamise came on as a substitute, and there is no question that she has pace to burn. We know that. We know how direct she is and how lethal she can be on the wing. But time after time after time, that final ball let her down. And for me, I don't think she was a particular standout of the World Cup, mate.
So what you're saying is, and this is me paraphrasing, that if you were to eliminate Tomis from that list and include Sauerbrunn as a defender, you'd be okay?
Yeah, I don't see why not. I think you want the best players in there, and for me, Elodie Tomis wasn't the best player for France. I don't think, you know, I know Eugenie Le Sommer is in there. I thought she had a decent tournament, but I don't think Elodie Tomis, while she had a good tournament, I don't think she was one of the best players in the tournament. I don't think she had the influence on her team that allowed them to progress to where they were and to potentially go beyond that.
But I think, you know, a few of these players on the list, I don't know the technical team, and this is completely my opinion here. And it looked like for a few of these selections, they saw, okay, so the U.S. won the tournament. Let's name, you know, X amount of players. You know, Japan finished second. Let's name X amount of players, and so on and so forth. And then he had a few wild cards. Ramona Bachmann in there obviously was the big standout for the Swiss team, and you know, you go on and on, but... Yeah, no, I mean, again, it's going to be one of those things that there's always talking points, and you know, Becky Sauerbrunn, in my opinion, deserved to be there and may have very well been the defender of the tournament, but you know, that's again my opinion.
And that's it, and these lists are about opinions, and it generates conversation and it generates debate, and I think that's what the key thing is. You know, I could name a number of other players. Steph Catley made my team of the tournament. I thought she was excellent for Australia in a very difficult group. A lot of people commented on how good Asisat Oshoala was, and Nigeria didn't get beyond the group stages. So you may well be right. There are a lot of the players in that list that feature... The list features a lot of players that got into the latter rounds of the competition, whereas the Lady Andrada for Colombia... really exciting to watch. You know, just because these players didn't get to the later rounds of the competition doesn't mean they shouldn't be considered. And I think looking at the list of players that are in there, I don't think there's, other than Switzerland, Ramona Bachmann, I don't think there's many in there that have gone less than the quarterfinals. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe that's something they need to look at in future. No Brazilians in there, which is well... That's certainly an interesting one when you think about how powerful a team they've been over the years. But Becky Sauerbrunn was definitely the major talking point from an American fan's perspective. And for anyone that genuinely follows the game and saw how composed and how influential she was. And actually, I managed to interview her, not about this, but I did manage to speak to her about a little bit about the World Cup. But also I was interested to talk to her about her mental and physical strength, because Becky, up until the game against Costa Rica on Saturday, which we will talk about in the next show, had played every game for the US Women's National Team this year. And not only played every game, she'd started every game as well. So for me, when you play in such an intense environment, in such a top side, against such top-class opposition, I was interested to know how she goes about preparing for matches, and also just how she's finding playing in that team at the moment, and obviously being alongside the likes of Julie Johnston, Ali Krieger and Megan Klingenberg. So really nice interview with Becky. She was superb. So have a listen, and here she is. Okay, so I'm delighted to be joined by Becky Sauerbrunn for this edition of Women's Soccer Zone, someone I've wanted to get on for quite a long time. Becky, thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
Playing professional soccer since the World Cup has ended, so it hasn't been much break for us, but it's been good.
I can imagine FCKC doing well since your return, obviously in those playoff places just about at the moment. Well, you mentioned you've been playing since the World Cup, and there's nowhere really better to start. What's it been like since that epic day in Vancouver? We've seen you all over the place doing victory parades and various media all over the US. For you personally, how has it been since that day 5 weeks ago?
It's been very busy. It's been wonderful. I mean, celebrating the World Cup, we have been everywhere, but it's been amazing things like the parade in New York and then the ESPYs in Los Angeles. So no real complaints. It's just been busy and, you know, trying to do a lot of appearances for the national team and for my professional team while also playing. So it's a lot, but it's all good things and no complaints.
You will have known, no doubt, that when you won that final that the interest would have been quite big. With England over here, when they finished third, there was a lot of interest in the England team. And I spoke to Kelly Smith last week for an interview that, I did for a newspaper over here, and she said she'd been really surprised by the amount of attention the England team had got. Were you surprised by the level of attention that you guys got when you returned to America after the World Cup win, or was it something that you were kind of expecting?
No, I was very surprised. You know, we kind of tried to keep a bubble while we were in Canada, and not listen too much to the media. You know, it's a hard thing to do, but as much as possible, just kind of stay in that bubble. But we kept hearing kind of the amount of people watching our games and how it kept bumping up into like 5 million, 10 million, 20 million, 25 million. So we knew we were generating a lot of interest. And then when we got back and, you know, they offered to have a ticker tape parade, which is kind of a huge historic honor, we were, I think, all really surprised, but really, really honored to have something like that gifted to us.
How do you deal with that? I mean, I saw for myself the media scrum that occurs at your games. I was out in Winnipeg for your group games, and I saw something that I'd never seen before. The game over here in England is growing, and it's growing in popularity, but when I came out to Winnipeg and was in that mix zone and was in those press conferences and I saw the level of interest in you guys, it was like nothing I've ever seen before. It was on another level. How do you guys deal with that while concentrating on what's the most important thing, which is what's going on the field?
It's tough. It's tough because we definitely want to make our team accessible to the public. And so, you know, we're very willing to do the interviews and the press conferences and things like that. But it's tough because we weren't playing as well as we wanted to at the beginning of the tournament. So a lot of that media and press was kind of negative. So it's tough to, you know, not let that enter into our bubble while also trying to, you know, give people a sneak peek of what it's like, you know, behind the scenes with our team. So it's good and it's bad with media. I think it's great that people were so interested in getting to know us and to watch the game. And I think it's a great step for women's soccer that the press was not okay with us just winning the games. It was how we were winning the game. So it's nice to see that women's soccer has reached that level where we're actually getting critiqued and people were expecting more of us than just, you know, eking out these wins. So it was, you know, it's bittersweet, the media.
Is that one of the things that you have to kind of almost accept and deal with, that as the game grows, and especially in the US where there is so much attention on you guys, that you are going to be open to more scrutiny? Because I know that, especially over here in England and certainly in other places as well, if you criticise women's football or if you criticise individual players or teams, that you can sometimes get a lot of backlash from supporters saying, oh, you can't criticise them, it's women's football, you have to let the players develop. But we're open to criticising the men's game, so is it something that we have to accept that might happen more and more in the women's game as it becomes more popular?
Absolutely. I think if we want to get to the level where the men are, as far as interest from, you know, fans, from public and things like that, we absolutely have to get to that point where we're okay with getting criticized. Because when you look at all the major sports, I mean, you look at soccer over in England, but then you look at, you know, the NFL or, you know, Major League Baseball here in the States, you see that criticism, and it's part of that. So if we want women's soccer to get on that level with all the other streamlined sports here in America, we have to be ready for that, and it has to become something that we expect and that we get used to.
Well, you mentioned that you didn't necessarily start the tournament as you would have liked, but one of the real highlights from my perspective and a lot of the media and supporters and I think supporters of the game, not just the US, was the relationship and the partnership that you developed with Julie Johnston during that tournament, starting out and then it growing and growing. I mean, you've played alongside some great defenders in your time, Christy Rampone, Rachel Van Hollebeck. How was it that you managed to really click with Julie so soon and so quickly when you haven't actually played that much together over the last couple of years since she made her debut?
I think a lot of that goes to Julie, because she stepped in with little to no experience at the highest level and just fit in seamlessly and had a wonderful tournament and was making big plays. And we were both very willing to play off one another. It wasn't that she had to adapt to me or I had to adapt to her. We're willing to compliment one another and try to kind of make each other's strengths shine while hiding each other's weaknesses. And I think that's a rare thing to find in a center back partnership. But when you get it, I think you can see that it really helps the team. It really works. And I'm really lucky that Julie came in when she did. And, I mean, I give a lot of credit to Jules because she's a stud. And, you know, the privilege to play next to her.
But at the same time, you've been in that position where you're the younger and the more inexperienced. I mentioned the fact that you've played alongside Rachel and Christy. So you've been in those shoes. So did you take it upon yourself to try and take that leadership role and try and guide her through those games? You say that you give her a lot of credit, but it takes two to tango. So I'm sure that she would be as complimentary of you as you are of her.
Yeah, I think since, you know, Christy and Whitney Angen, they had some injury problems early on in the year. I had to accept a little bit of that as a leadership. I mean, I had Allie Krieger, who, you know, had played in a World Cup before, who was very experienced. And then on my left, I had Megan Klingenberg, who was also relatively new, but had played in some really high quality matches leading up to the tournament. So I think the leadership kind of fell on all of us, and we were all willing to accept responsibility for the back line. And so I would say, you know, I was the most experienced on that back line, but it was very much an easy role because of the experience that I had around me.
I spoke to Megan Klingenberg very briefly in the mix zone after one of the games, and I commented on how Jill Ellis likes to rotate her forward players quite a lot. There's an abundance of attacking talent in that squad, and there's a lot of competition in the defensive area as well. But when I look at the stats for the World Cup, yourself, Hope Solo, Megan Klingenberg, Julie Johnston, 630 minutes. She played every minute of every game, and I think Allie Krieger missed maybe only 9 minutes. I think it was 620 odd minutes. How important is it to have that continuity and having the same faces and the same bodies around you to really make a solid unit to ensure that you're able to get through that tournament?
I think chemistry is huge, and I think if you have a back line that we did that was really gelling and really working, it makes a big difference. I think we had a little bit of an attacking where we weren't quite getting things done that we wanted the way they were getting done. So they had to kind of use those subs sometimes for the attack. And so it was, I think, fortunate for our team that the back line was stayed healthy, you know, kept playing at a high level so that we could kind of tinker with that attacking shape. Because I think as the World Cup went on, those major changes that we did with Morgan Brying and Carly Lloyd, I think were the difference of, you know, winning that championship.
How much time do you guys spend away from the field together? We hear about the goalkeepers union where they have their own training sort of sessions and setups where they sometimes are away from the outfield players and they're kind of doing their own thing. But for you as defensive units, how important is it that you're able to communicate and get on off the pitch as well as on it? Because you're spending a lot of time together at a tournament, you're spending a lot of time in hotels, on training grounds. How important is it that you're able to kind of take that relationship on the field, off the field when you're not involved in a game?
We're all professionals. And so, you know, the 23-woman roster, you're not going to be best friends with everybody. That's just very far-fetched. But you definitely have people that you tend to gravitate towards that, you know, you're very like-minded. And I think it just so happened that Queen, me, Jules, and Kriegs, that we are those people, we kind of gravitate towards one another. Off the field, and I think kind of that chemistry that is formed off does translate well onto the field. I wouldn't say because, you know, I'm better friends with Klingenberg that I work harder for her. I don't think that's true. I work hard for everybody equally on the field. It's, you know, mutual respect and love for everybody. But I do think that kind of the understanding of one another, kind of knowing when one player is, you know, a little down or can't find themselves in the game, just knowing that because I've spent time with them off the field, maybe I can say a word for confidence, you know, kind of put their butt in gear, like whatever I need to do to get them back to playing at their peak. I think that is forged off the field as well as on.
We're talking about relationships. I was quite interested to see during the tournament that you did a little Q&A through the US Women's National Team Twitter account, and Kelly O'Hara fired a cheeky question over to you about if a hotel was burning and you could save Morgan Brying, Julie Johnston or me, who would it be? And your answer was, I'd knock Mo Brien out and carry her on my shoulders like a scarf, hold you like a baby and drag Julie Johnston out of the fire. You stand by that in that order?
Would I save them in that order?
Yeah.
I mean, I would assume that Morgan would start panicking, so I'd have to knock her out so that she'd, like, stay quiet and chill. And then Kelly is kind of the slightest of us all, so I could have to, I could carry her like a baby. And then Jules, I just have to drag. So, I mean, it was kind of an unfair question. You can't really choose one of your teammates over two of the others, so I had to find a way to save off the three of them. So I think it was a pretty great answer. It kind of inspired a lot of, like, fan art. Like, I got a lot of, you know, CGI posters of me doing those three things, which is pretty funny.
No, the ESPN women's site that I've dragged that from described the answer as epic. So I think you did pretty well there under difficult circumstances with lots of people looking at the Twitter account at the time, I'm sure. But, I mean, I mentioned the fact that you had that solid unit and the fact that you played every minute of every game. But you, Becky, have played every single game for the US women's national team in 2015. I think it's 17 games in total. With that added on top of your commitments with FC Casey, how do you maintain that level of fitness and ensuring that you're not a victim of injury? Because you play such an intense game, the US, it's based on high level, high tempo, coming up against some of the best players in the world. And we all know, and I'm not going to go into detail on it, but we all know that you had to play the tournament on turf, and you have to play some of your league games in the NWSL on turf as well. How do you look after yourself? Because to play virtually every game, every minute of every game, that's a big ask, and yet you're able to do that time after time.
I think it's a couple of things. I think I'm a center back, so I have the luxury of most of the pressure coming in front of me. So I'm the one that's, you know, tackling people, usually being tackled. So I think, in a way, the position that I play helps me to stay a little bit more safe than others. I'm pretty much a fanatic when it comes to strength, conditioning, speed, agility. I really like doing, I like being in the weight room. I like doing functional movement stuff off the field. I think that's helped me stay healthy, but also has kind of done well for me on the field as far as my movements and things like that. And then I also think partly that it's luck, you know. Some tackles, some, you know, movements, and people get hurt, and I feel like I've just been really fortunate, and, you know, hopefully that continues. I'm going to knock on wood for that. But, yeah, I think it's those kind of a combination of those three things.
And how much does it come down to mental strength? I spoke to Diana Matheson last week. She appeared on the last Women's Soccer Zone, and we spoke about the mental strength it takes to get over a serious injury like she had when she came back to the World Cup. How much of it is mental strength in terms of not just recovering from serious injury, but making sure that you prevent serious injuries from happening?
I think that's a huge part of it. I think when you compare people who, you know, play at the international level to those that are in the professional league, I think the biggest difference is mental toughness. And I think it's those that are most consistent, those that are willing to grind, that make it to the next level. So I think that's a big thing. I think that you have to be willing to sacrifice so much in order to reap the rewards that, you know, a national team can give you. And so I think that's been a part of my game that as I've gotten older, I've gotten better at. I think, you know, when I was out of college trying to make the national team, I wasn't quite there as far as confidence and mental toughness and willing to grind it out. So I think that's a huge thing that I've acquired as I've gotten older.
And how much was that mental strength applied to that World Cup that we've seen you pick up this past summer out in Canada? You said already that it didn't exactly start in terms of the performances how you wanted to, but I think fans and viewers of the World Cup would agree that the team just got better and better and better with every game. How much was that kind of mental strength, not just in yourself, but in that team? How much did that play in taking you all the way to the title?
We knew that we weren't playing the way that we wanted to in the group stage, and then also in Colombia. China was that kind of changing point for us. We weren't there, and we knew it wasn't working, and I think it was good for us to acknowledge that. And we weren't placing blame on anyone. It wasn't the attack. It wasn't the defense. It was the entire team, because we were all responsible for attacking and defending. So the fact that we acknowledged it, that we knew we weren't playing the way we wanted to, but that we knew how we wanted to play, and we were getting there slowly but surely. So it was tough, but it wasn't. We never doubted ourselves. We knew that we had the talent to win the World Cup. It was just a matter of, you know, tinkering and finding the way that we wanted to do it. And really, the biggest shift for us was we felt we were too much on the back foot. We wanted to be on the front foot and really press and attack and win balls higher up on the field, which I think you saw in the China game. And I think that really kind of flipped the switch for us, and that we mentally were just stronger and feistier, and I think that made a big difference for us.
In that final, you're on the back line, you're playing just in front of Hope Solo, and in front of you, you've got some of the best attacking players in the world who've put you 4-0 up inside the first 15-20 minutes. What's going through your mind when you see Carly Lloyd lob the Japan goalkeeper to put you guys 4-0 up and you're coasting after 20 minutes? Can you believe what you're witnessing?
Oh, not at all. I was like, this dream is getting ridiculous. I need to wake up because there's no way that we would be up 4-0 in 20 minutes. It's one of those games that it just is not real. It just doesn't feel real. And the fact that Carly was, you know, playing lights out and scoring these amazing goals, it was crazy. And I'd never really played in a game like that. But it's interesting that when we went into halftime and it was 4-1, I almost felt more, not scared, but I was nervous because, okay, if we could score 4 goals in 20 minutes, was it going to be that weird type of soccer game where the other team could score 4 goals in 20 minutes? So it was almost like I was more nervous. We were up by 3 goals as opposed to maybe if we had been down by 1 or 2 goals. It was strange, but it helped, you know, getting into halftime and people saying, all right, guys, like, this is great. This is a wonderful start, but let's go out in that second half and you know, let's think that the game is tied because we cannot let our foot off the pedal because you never know what could happen, especially with a very high-quality Japanese team.
And then Yuki Igimi makes it 4-2. You said you were nervous going into halftime, 3 goals up. How are you feeling after she's brought it back to 2 difference?
That I was mad. I was like, okay, this is not happening. Because, you know, we had done so well and, you know, all those shutouts and those shutout minutes, and we gave up a goal. It was a quality finish in the first half. You know, fine, I'll clap my hands for it. That was a great goal. But then when the second one went in, I was like, okay, that's it. There's no more goals going in. So I actually felt more comfortable and in control then. And then by the time Tobin put that 5th goal in, I think we were just cruising.
And then you go up, final whistle goes, and you get the opportunity to put your hands on that World Cup, the first women's national team, or the first US women's national team to do so since 1999, a team that people have spoken about for years and years afterwards. Does this feel like, when you put your hands on that trophy, did it feel like you'd just created your own chapter? You know, people are talking about that team, Mia Hamm, Christine Lilly, Julie Foudy. Now you guys have got your trophy. You've almost had your own chapter. Is that kind of how it felt in a way?
It does. I know that for me, the 1999 team, they were so iconic. And the moment that they won the World Cup in 99, that was the moment for me where I knew I wanted to be on the national team and I wanted to experience what they had experienced. So for me, that team is just so huge in my mind and in my childhood. And it's hard for me to think that maybe people feel that way about our team. Maybe because, you know, I'm on the team and I was, you know, part of the team that won the World Cup. But for some reason, that 99 team always, for me, it just seems so huge. So it hasn't really settled, I think, with me that we could do something similar. And maybe time will tell. But for right now, it still feels like a little surreal.
But then when you look at the number of people that turned out for the parade in New York and who turned out in Los Angeles when you guys returned from the World Cup. I mean, we're talking about, you know, hero status. We're talking about probably the one team along with some individual players from different countries who are seen as celebrities. And it could well be that you are going to be the Julie Foudys and the Mia Hamms and the Michelle Akers of the next 10, 15 years, inspiring the young girls who witnessed this World Cup to go and want to play in the U.S. women's national team and emulate people like yourself.
I hope so. I think that would be an honor and a privilege to be part of the team that can motivate the next generation of women soccer players, but also just athletes in general.
Brilliant. Well, I think it was a tremendous, tremendous tournament for anyone to witness, and certainly you made a huge statement in that final, especially in the first half with the game against Japan. I'm just going to finish up on a very light note, Becky. Have you taken out the garbage since you got back? That was another question that came from your boyfriend during the Q&A that you did with the US Women's National Team Twitter account. Have you taken the garbage out since you got back?
I have not. That's not something that I have done.
Well, I wanted to throw that one in just to end on a light-hearted note, but look, it's been a genuine pleasure. I wanted to try and do the interview a little bit differently to the ones that you've probably done already, speaking about some of the challenges that a defender like yourself can face and some of the mental and physical challenges that you come up against. But it's been really insightful, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Women's Soccer Zone. Listen to the show on Audioboom or download via iTunes. Just search for Women's Soccer Zone.
So that was Becky Sauerbrunn, honest and insightful and without a doubt one of the people that I've wanted to get on here for quite a while. So Becky, thank you very much for giving us your time. And that concludes episode 17, part 1, JJ. If it wasn't enough for people to have this episode, they've got more to come this week because we have a lovely interview with Carly Lloyd. We have NWSL Roundup. We have US Women's National Team Roundup from the game against Costa Rica. There is loads more to come. So I bet you're damn excited.
Oh, yeah, that's a good word. I didn't know we could drop a damn in there every once in a while. But, yeah, no, it's the summer of soccer in America is still very strong and alive.
We can drop dams, we can drop balls, we can drop whatever we like in there, mate. This is our show. We can do what we want. But look, mate, always a pleasure. I think, you know, we've covered off a lot. And there is still more to come, so we won't keep the listeners for any longer. But remember that if you want to contact us, you can do. We are on wosozone@gmail.com if you want to email us. We're on @wosozone on Twitter, and the show is available on iTunes and at Audioboom, which is audioboom.com/wosozone. JJ, I'll talk to you later in the week when we cover off part 2, but thanks very much for this one, mate.
No problem. Looking forward to our next one.
And we will speak to you all very soon.